Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Welcome to Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny, Director of the Australian Studies Institute at ANU, and I'm talking this week with a Democracy Sausage favourite, prolific author and all-round historian, particularly of Australia and Australian Labor, about his new old book with Nick Dryenforth called A Little History of the Australian Labor Party. It's a revised edition of their 2011 book. And Frank, welcome to Democracy Sausage again.
Oh, thanks, Mark. It's lovely to be here.
Now, before we go into this book, I want to talk about another book because you've just written about another book, which is one called Plans for Your Good. I mean, I find this title somewhat incongruous, but anyway, Plans for Your Good, A Prime Minister's Testimony of God's Faithfulness by Scott Morrison. Interesting book. You've just read it. You've reviewed it for The Conversation with Joshua Black, I think. Tell us about it. It seems like what is this book?
Well, obviously ours was really poorly timed, Mark, because we're competing with Scott Morrison.
And God. You're competing with God, I think.
With God, indeed. I did a review with Josh Black, which we sort of were able to console each other and boost each other up as we read it. So it was definitely the kind of thing to be jointly reviewed. We I think, agreed at the end that we'd been a wonderful moral support to one another. It's extraordinary. Book. I mean, it's not a conventional political memoir, and that's not an argument against it, of course. The genre is an old and perhaps sometimes getting a little bit tired.
Formulaic
and vindictive too, of course. I mean, we've seen a number of these over the years. I mean, I suppose the notorious Hawke and Latham efforts of years ago where there was a lot of payback. Well, there's no payback here.
But it does conform to at least one fairly consistent theme in Prime Minister's memoirs. There's no real admission of wrongdoing.
No, it's
most
lying.
Prime Ministers got everything right. It's just right. Other people didn't understand it at the time, or
it's light on in the confessional department. I mean, its genre is kind of Christian autobiography, and I suppose back to Saint Augustine.
That's very niche.
I mean, Augustine wrote about confessions, and there's not much in the way of confession here. He does acknowledge getting some things wrong during the pandemic, for instance, but I guess some of those more notorious.
And what are those things? Is that in the messaging or is that in the timing of decisions?
Oh, the vaccination program and the lack of rapid antigen tests. I mean, he acknowledges some error around that. He acknowledges that he made a mistake in supporting Clive Palmer's attempt to open the border with Western Australia, although he is critical of state premiers, keeping lockdowns going too long, keeping borders closed. I mean, rather hypocritical when you consider that, one of the reasons they had to in 2021, shaving, if I remember rightly, probably $30 billion off the economy, was that the vaccination program, failed. It was too slow. The strollouts, as it was called. And then the shortage of test kits and all the rest of it really gave the premiers very little option, one might argue.
And it's also true to say, just quickly on that, that the lockdowns, even if they were heavy-handed, and some aspects of them they quite clearly were, but there was a lot of erring on the side of caution, both on the expenditure side of the budget, but also in some other restrictions that the states had, the primary responsibility for. But overall, the physical compartmentalisation of Australia behind state borders was a critical part of Australia's overall performance in managing the pandemic, you know, flattening the curve, as we used to say early on in the piece, and lowering the number of infections and deaths.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly...
Which he wanted to be, you know, he was very happy to take the credit for that.
That's true. He did in the lead up to the 2022 election. You know, he was sort of enumerating the number of lives he thought his policies had saved. I mean, I think he remains adamant, as I think most of us would, that, you know, closing the external borders was a good thing and happened in a timely way. I mean, some of us might be critical of Australians being left stranded overseas and that kind of thing.
But yeah, I'd be one of them.
Yeah, well, indeed, yeah. But, yeah, he's less enamoured of some of the more stringent things that state premiers did. And I wonder, too, whether there's an element of playing to his audience here. I mean, this is a book written for an American evangelical audience. He hastens to add that he wasn't into vaccine mandates, for instance, and we know that that kind of idea is not liked in some elements of the American right, including...
Well, if you think about the orientation that he is writing this from himself as a Pentecostal Christian, and the readership that he's looking to access in the United States, it would probably be an unwise commercial decision to come out in favour of mandates, wouldn't it? I mean, this is a sort of a pretty live debate.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I think this is very much a book that is intended to launch some sort of American career for him. I mean, obviously, he's doing that in the defence industry, but I rather suspect that he envisages some sort of career in American evangelical politics / religion. And the book's, you know, really full of biblical stories and scriptural quotation. I mean, it's nothing like Turnbull's autobiography or the Latham Diaries. This is something quite different. And yes, that strange title, which in some ways reflects a kind of, I think, rather transactional approach to religion that we find here. The idea is that if you have problems and worries, you can somehow transfer these to God, which is not something I recall from my own Catholic upbringing.
No, I don't recall that either. I seem to remember lugging around all the problems.
Indeed. You sort of lugged them around until you could go off to confession. So It's a fascinating book in some ways because of the particular genre he's chosen for it. I mean, there are some conventional aspects. I mean, yes, he talks about the pandemic. He talks about AUKUS and makes it clear that this is, you know, a great Morrison achievement and legacy. Yes, he wants to tell us that, you know, he didn't plot against Turnbull, that he didn't lie to Emmanuel Macron, all that sort of stuff that you'd expect in an orthodox political memoir where there's always lots of self-vindication. But that's really not where the balance of the book lies. The balance of the book is a fundamentalist, actually. I mean, he's setting out sort of religious framework for understanding his life and particularly his role in politics. There's almost no discussion of colleagues in it. There's little discussion of opponents in it. They almost don't figure at all.
Well, it was a one-man win in 2019, of course, as we know. So I suppose that partly informs it.
It does.
Or tells us something about him.
It goes beyond that, I think, though. I think it's about the way he wants to present himself in politics. He wants to present himself, I think, as a kind of alien among strangers, an alien among natives, I should say. You know, he wants to present himself as if he's out of his natural environment in going into politics. Now, this is extraordinary. I know,
literally laughable.
You may laugh, Mark, because this is a guy who was, as we say in the review, a politician to his boot heels. And in fact, I think he's still being a politician in the kind of book he has written here.
And as a former director of the New South Wales Liberal
Party
Division.
Indeed.
Played politics all the way through to his pre-selection and then all the way to the top.
Indeed, yeah. So it's an extraordinary way of presenting himself as this kind of alien among natives. But that's, I think, a part of the reason why he presents himself as alone, or rather alone accompanied by Jen and the girls.
Mm.
And, of course, he just doesn't touch a whole bunch of things that you'd go looking for in a memoir. I mean, there's nothing on the bushfires, the whole range of things that we associate with the Morrison prime ministership, particularly for ill, are just not there.
So,
the five ministries thing isn't the secret.
So no
ministries.
Five ministries, no sports warts, no railroad debt, White House lawn gate, Brian Houston at the dinner.
No, that's not there.
As you say, no mention of French naval group and all that. Although, does he say that he didn't lie to?
He talks about AUKUS and the background to that. But yes, there are whole aspects of this guy's prime ministership, and even more perhaps the earlier career that just don't figure at all. I mean, I don't think there's anything on his period as immigration minister. There's nothing on robo-debt, you know, all the kinds of things that you would look
there's
for.
A little flick at Fran Bailey, I seem to recall from your review.
Yeah, without mentioning her, which is another, you know, again.
So just to put it in perspective, so she's the tourism minister at the time. He's at Tourism Australia. And he says in this book that she was annoyed that he was getting too much media. There was a sort of an envy problem there, which is why he got sacked.
That's right. That's why she had to get rid of him, he says, without naming her.
That's a pretty serious thing to say, like that it's just driven by straight out envy. That's a very vindictive thing to say.
That is vindictive. So, yes, perhaps I'm going too far in saying that it's not a – I suppose you'd say it's less vindictive than some of the classic Australian political memoirs.
Oh, yeah. It's a vindictive genre, I think it's fair
indeed,
to say.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes. I mean, look, it's a very – strange book. I think it's a book that will be essential for anyone who's trying to make sense of Morrison as a politician. I remember us talking about this, Mark, probably when he first became Prime Minister. I felt that there was something very impoverished about Morrison's political language, you know, how good is Australia? I mean, it always sounded so hokey. And I always wondered whether one of the reasons for that sense of its poverty was that instinctively, he would have a much more religiously orientated rhetoric. And I think he would have something closer to what is conventional, perhaps within certain elements of US politics. But you can't do that in Australia.
No.
I mean, rather like, what was it? I think it was Alistair Campbell, wasn't it? Said to Tony Blair, we don't do God. And I think Australian politics is pretty similar in that respect. And I think he was always hampered in that he really had to have a more or less purely secular language. He did veer away at times, but generally, his rhetoric was a secular one, which is conventional in Australian politics. And I think its poverty perhaps owed something to the fact that instinctively
that there was a part of him that he was holding back.
And now he's not holding the back. I mean, it's there, it's laid out.
And I think that's actually an interesting observation to make about this, because we saw that speech that Scott Morrison made after he'd lost the prime ministership after the election in 2022, talking to a Pentecostal group over there. And that's when he made that remark about, we don't trust in governments, we don't trust the United Nations, we trust God. I don't have the quote in front of me, but that was the gist of it. Yeah. And I think since the prime ministership, we've seen this side of him coming out, and that really just does, I suppose, expose the fact that we didn't really know who he was, that he won in 2019 essentially as the kind of anti-Shorten, as the anti-Labor candidate, running almost as if in opposition to a Labor agenda that was being put forward in 2019. So we'd inherited this prime minister midterm, then we kind of stuck with him at that election. And then 22 came along and he was gone, and we'd start to find out more about him since.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. That, you know, that notion that he was holding something back. Obviously, we knew about his religiosity. We knew that, you know, that he was obviously an active member of his particular church, Horizon, wasn't it? That he had relations with figures like Brian Houston. And so we kind of knew that, but I don't think people came to grips fully with the extent to which his whole, if you like, approach to politics was being framed by a kind of a fundamentally religious, Pentecostal, very individualistic kind of religious vision.
And this speaks very much to him as a politician, because a political judgment has been made here about how to present himself, basically stripped of all of this profound belief structure that, as you say, he's sort of unguarded about it now.
Yeah, that's right. It was a decision to perform in particular ways, to create the kinds of persona that he did. I mean, the ScoMo image, which was of the sort of daggy dad kind of idea. And it was, it was a certain kind of political persona that marginalised his Pentecostalism. It sort of put it aside in a way. People knew it was there, but it wasn't fundamental to the kind of image that he presented to the public during those years.
Yeah, and I think he said at times that religion didn't determine the way he did the job.
Yeah.
If he said that now, in light of this book, is that a viable statement?
It still probably would be in some ways, because we don't get much insight really into whether, you know, his religion plays a role in specific decision making or whether it lies behind specific policy choices, because he doesn't deal with much of that in the book. I mean, he tells us about reading the Bible each day. He makes it clear that he had, I think, a WhatsApp group of pastors, as he calls them, who he was consulting and talking with regularly outside party politics. So we do get some interesting revelations of that kind, but we don't really get a strong sense of the relationship between, you know, specific policies or political action and his religion. I mean, he sometimes sees himself as Daniel, you know, in the lion's den and so on. He sometimes sees himself as Moses with his staff. And that's, I think, a very important image for Morrison because it sort of captures, I think, how he understands the relationship between religion and politics or belief in God and political action. The staff, of course, you know, it's a traditional symbol of authority. And Moses uses the staff to part the Red Sea, to give, you know, the Israelites advantages in battle over their enemies and all the rest of it. So it takes a man to raise the staff in the way that Moses does, but it's God's power and God's plan and God's will that's being expressed through that action. And I think that's how Morrison wants us to understand the relationship between his political actions and God's plan and God's will. It's very strange. I mean, you know, if you're brought up in as a Catholic, Mark, you know, I have to say a lot of this stuff's pretty strange.
Yeah, well, I guess people who aren't brought up as Catholics would say the Catholics are pretty strange as well.
That's true, but, you know, it just it's very individualistic too.
Well, we might come to that in a minute, actually, because Catholicism is a particularly interesting theme in the context of the Australian Labor
Indeed,
Party.
Indeed, that's right. Yeah.
So let's go to your book with Nick Tryon Firth called A Little History of the Australian Labor Party. I suppose a bit like it was the case asking you about Morrison's book. What is the purpose of this book? Give us a sort of the elevator pitch.
Yeah, so it's a second edition. It's an expanded edition from a book, as you said, that came out in 2011. And it was always designed, we thought, for people who didn't perhaps know a great deal about the Labor Party's history. They could be younger people who perhaps might be contemplating some sort of involvement in political life, maybe even just at the level of joining a Labor Party branch. We hope, too, that it would be of interest to people who are not necessarily in sympathy with the Labor Party. I mean, broadly speaking, it is a case for the constructive role that the Labor Party has played, without being uncritical, of course. But we hope that it would be an introduction, I suppose, to Australian politics, but particularly to the Labor Party for those who are not perhaps steeped in its history and traditions.
And if you were going to look at Australian politics and at a political party, for example, that would give you the best snapshot of Australian politics, then you would probably have to do it with this party because, as you say in the book, it's 133 years old. It's one of the oldest sort of Labor or social democratic parties in the world. Unlike the parties that have, I mean, they seem stable now, relatively speaking, you know, the coalition on the right and Labor in the centre left. But that's not been the case. I mean, the Liberal Party is only a creation really effectively since the Second World War.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you're looking for a single party and aiming to tell a story of, in VEEP, isn't it, continuity and change, this would be
continuity through change.
Continuity through change. This would be the place to do it. I mean, the only serious rival in Australian politics is actually the National Party, which effectively goes back to the First World War and is also a very interesting story in adaptation. I mean, there's some very interesting parallels, I think, between the ways that the country, now the National Party, adapted to really quite dramatic changes in the Australian economy and society and the way in which the Labor Party has also done that.
And some surprising overlaps, I think, for people who are not familiar with it, particularly in Queensland, where the National Party has been a party of government in its own right at the state level. And it being the major party there, with the Liberals as the minor coalition party before they were effectively made into one party. But you talk to people like Bob Katter about the period before, you know, when his father was involved, and there's very much an overlap between the sort of old blue-collar regional workers being either in Labor or the Nats.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, in Victoria in 20s, 30s, I mean, really, there was a country party, if you like, that was really closely aligned with Labor rather than the non-Labor party. So, you know, it was always a bit up for grabs which way the country party would go. But I think what's interesting is the way that the country party beginning really as a party of farmers, adapted itself into a party of other social groups, and particularly, I think, the party of the regions. The Labor Party has similarly had to adapt because, you know, it's a party really born in many ways of a very different economy from ours today, a pastoral agricultural economy of the 1880s and 1890s, an industrialising economy of the late 19th and early 20th century. But then, you know, what happens when you get to the post-World War II era where you're getting deindustrialization, where you're getting the rise of the professions, the rise of a new, more educated middle class? Well, you get Whitlam in the end, of course. And so those
and
sorts
Dunstan.
Of...
Yeah.
And Dunstan, indeed. Dunstan first, really, and then Whitlam. So, yeah, I think parallel stories of adaptation that are quite interesting.
And you write in here that the Labor Party's obviously has been around all that time, but in terms of its electoral success, hasn't been huge. Took a long time to have any presence in the states. Now it's very much a party of the states. It seems to be like the resting position of the states, perhaps because states are where services are delivered and there's that sort of much closer retail relationship. But in the first part of the 20th century, very hard for Labor to make gains in state governments.
Yeah, it varied in the states. I mean, you're absolutely right about the national picture is pretty clear, isn't it? That, you know, since the emergence of the two-party system, which really is, you know, about 1909, Labor's been in government for about a third of the time. And a coalition or sometimes a non-Labor party not in coalition has governed for the rest of the time, so about two-thirds of the time. And, you know, that wouldn't have been predicted in 1909 or 1910. I've been very influenced by the late John Hirst, a brilliant historian, who argued that the country seemed to be at the Labor Party's feet in those years before the First World War. It really did look as if it was going to be the dominant party in Australian politics. I mean, it was well ahead of its counterparts in Britain and in Europe in terms of acquiring power. It had control of both houses at the 1910 election. You would have predicted that the 20th century was going to belong to Labor. Now, that's not what happened.
Because it was, in a sense, it was more organised and unified, right, as a political party, and those other parties needed to organise themselves, and it became a force for organising the forces against it.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it looked and was organisationally stronger. It had the trade unions behind it at a time when trade unions were taking in larger and larger proportions of the workforce, partly under a system of compulsory industrial arbitration that promoted union organisation, but also a sense that the state was becoming a much more powerful entity in society and the economy during that period. Everything seemed to be going for the Labor Party and for the kinds of politics that the Labor Party represented. It was also a party that seemed to be very good at balancing the claims of British imperialism with Australian nationalism and identified with both. Now, of course, all this came crashing down in 1916 over the issue of conscription for overseas service. We'd crystallised, I guess, some of the tensions sitting there between, you know, empire and nation, between the goals of the party to raise living standards and the need for sacrifice in the context of war. So it fell apart, it split, and was never the same again, you could argue. I mean, it came to power briefly during the Depression, and it split again, you know, within a couple of years. When Curtin became Prime Minister, not because of an election, but because of a couple of independents switching sides, I've described that elsewhere as kind of a triumph of faith and hope over experience, because you would not have given a cracker for the ability of the Labor Party to actually govern Australia effectively in the Second World War, because we know it did.
And it held out as really the gold standard. I mean, people like Hawke and other leaders, Keating, they always cite Curtin as the hero Prime Minister, the one who did such a monumental task governing Australia in a time of crisis.
Yeah, and Curtin's great achievement, I think, too, was he managed to navigate the challenges of the Second World War without splitting his party. You know, when he wanted to introduce a limited form of conscription, he didn't do a Hughes. He actually brought the party with him, and he had some incredibly turbulent individuals in his cabinet, troublemakers left, right and centre, but able to manage a reasonably effective team, as did Chifley afterwards. I mean,
Chifley was very much his partner in government as well as his treasurer, right?
Yeah, his partner, a less charismatic, a less brilliant figure, I think, but a very respected one with an incredibly persuasive personality. It was often said of Chifley, he never really ordered anyone to do anything. It was always couches, would you mind doing such and such? Mm. And people always did. So the 40s was in a lot of ways, and ironically perhaps, the salvation of the Labor Party nationally. It showed that it could govern, but then it's out of office then for 23 years until Whitlam. During those years, as you say, Mark, I mean, Labor did on the whole experience greater success in state politics. The two big exceptions, I think, to that, one, South Australia, where the non-Labor parties were in government, what, from 1933 through to 65, Tom Playford for most of that time. Some said really a kind of almost de facto Labor premier in some ways. I mean, very, he nationalised the electricity supply, for instance, in 1945.
ETSA, as it was called, Electricity Trust of South Australia. Yeah. Of course, I grew up there, and we used to go swimming in a little dam or sort of a lake over at the National Park, and it was called Tom's Puddle. Only years later did I work out it was actually called the Sir Thomas Playford Lake or something like that.
But, you know, you had the Housing Trust, which he didn't establish. In fact, he opposed originally back in the 30s, but became very associated with him, you know, the incredibly expansive public housing. And just generally, that was a great example of a non-Labor premier and non-Labor parties embracing the fact that the state is becoming a much more powerful force in society and not trying to resist it, actually going with the flow in a sense. Mm. But so
Labor, which was absolutely vital in a smaller economy like South Australia and made South Australia into a manufacturing sort of powerhouse.
Yeah, it was about, you know, they went for awards that were slightly below the national standard. The provision of housing obviously was a draw for immigrants.
Huge,
lower taxes for multinationals coming in and setting up in South Australia and so on. And he got on very well with Chifley, of course. I mean, that was a very close, cordial relationship. So South Australia is obviously a Labor wasteland in those years, and Victoria even more so. I mean, South Australia had Labor governments quite early, but there was no majority Labor government in Victoria until 1952. I mean, John Cain Sr. And really, you know,
that's amazing when you think about it.
Extraordinary, the most industrialised state in Australia.
Yeah.
It was partly a function of malapportionment, electoral malapportionment, also a big issue in South Australia, which meant that you got some really strange stuff in Victoria, like country party governments in the 1930s and early 40s, which were propped up by Labor, and they just kind of trade support in return for concessions. But look, in the other states, Labor tended to do reasonably well. I mean, Labor governed almost constantly in Queensland from 1915 through to 57. Labor tended to do pretty well in New South Wales, governed for most of the Menzies era, for instance. Was it 1941 to 65? Western Australia, long periods of Labor government there. Tasmania, the most dominant. I mean, that's where Labor actually did best of all. And again, very much aligned with the industrialisation. Yeah, I mean, Labor did on the whole do better in the states. And there's been this extraordinary turnaround, as you know, in the last, 40, 50 years really, where those Labor wastelands of South Australia and Victoria have become Labor heartlands. They've become the strongest places for Labor government.
Let's take a quick break. Back in a moment.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And now something new and exciting from ANU. It's called Policy Brief. And to explain it, I'm joined by Amy Capuano, who is the editor of Policy Brief. Amy, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thanks,
just to
Mike.
Explain what this is.
This is a new digital platform that we've made. And what we're saying is that it's for time-poor policymakers who need quick access to evidence-based research. That's my quick one-liner.
It's pretty good. I mean, that sounds pretty popular in a place like Canberra, I would have thought.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, I've just come myself from the public service, and what I know is that it's full of smart people who work really hard. smart people who don't have a lot of time to keep up with what is increasingly a more complex policy environment.
Yeah.
It's really hard to keep on top of that stuff.
These are fast-moving fields of knowledge where there's new developments all the time happening around the world, and that's what a place like ANU can deliver is. So we've got experts here making their professional life of forging this new these new frontiers of knowledge and staying up with it.
Exactly. I mean, we are rich. This is an intellectual powerhouse at ANU. So we're not short on expertise, but what we thought would fill a good gap is being able to translate that expertise. And so we're aiming specifically at policymakers with this website. So if you work in the public service, if you are in a ministerial office or in the PMO, or you might even be in an NGO and you're putting together some position papers, policy and papers, because they are policymakers too. Mm. And you don't have time to read a 30-page journal article. We are doing that work of pulling out what a policymaker would want to know. We don't want to just do an elegant description of the problem that we can all admire. It's like, well, where do we take this? Mm. What are those possible responses? We're pulling them out, headlining them for you, and then we're linking to the original paper. So we're not sacrificing substance in the name of brevity. So you can go to that paper and see all of the research there. But what we've done is shortcut that for you because we know that people don't have time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It sounds really, really apposite. I must say when I came across the lake from Capitol Hill to ANU, that was one of the things that I was most struck by was just the sheer amount of intellectual resource that was housed over here at ANU and which in a sense wasn't fully accessed, it wasn't fully taken advantage of by people in the press gallery, by policymakers, by departments. So it's a terrific way of enriching that and encouraging the use of that information, that expertise.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a good problem to have, right? Sort of being drowning in expertise. So what we're trying to do here is just cut through. This is very simple. We've got a really tight format here. We've really looked at this. We've tried to make this very, very straightforward. This is what is the one idea that this policy brief is trying to tell you, whether that's health costs for intimate partner violence and the implications for policymakers, or it could be what you can do as a policymaker to reshape teenagers' attitudes to vaping. So really, really specific things here. How you can maximise income tax revenue, how you can build support for big infrastructure projects, how you can the government can speed up renewable projects to meet our climate commitments. Yeah, There's a huge range, right?
Yeah. And it's always increasing that list, of course. How often will it be updated? Is it on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, it's an ongoing basis. So we're putting about two new pieces of content on there a week, and we send out a monthly newsletter which looks back at the previous month and highlights all the things that we've put up. So it sounds like a sales pitch, but I would love you to visit the website. It's policybrief.anu.edu.au, and there is a subscribe button on there. Subscribing really is the best way to keep up to date with those briefs. And like I said, it's a tool. It's very business-like, but it's not boring. The words are going to jump off the page. You'll be absolutely clear about what this policy brief is trying to tell you. So
you've sold it to me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amy Capuano, editor of ANU Policy Brief, and you can access that from now. Welcome back. Now, Frank, we were talking earlier in relation to the Morrison book about Catholicism and Pentecostalism in that case, but Catholicism and its alternatives, very much a sort of a strong feature in the history of the Labor Party. Of course, the Catholics play a very big role in the 1950s in what becomes known as the split, that cataclysmic moment. And we know that from Chifley in 49 right through to 1972, basically 23 years of always described as in the wilderness, of not being in government federally. It's really a picture of Australia as well, isn't it? But Catholics have been a very important foundation of the Labor Party and were very, very influential in that split.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the religious dimension and particularly, you know, sort of Protestant Catholic rivalries, I guess it's often called religious sectarianism, is utterly entangled in the story of Australian politics well before the Labor Party came along. I mean, I talked about this quite a bit in Dreamers and Schemers, so my general political history, but it is a big issue in the Labor Party. Look, the Labor Party, when it emerges in the 1890s, is an ecumenical organisation, and people underestimate that achievement, actually, that it was a space where Protestants and Catholics and Jews could cooperate for collective goals, for collective, mainly working class goals, and they were generally, on the whole, able to put aside denominational rivalries. Now, there is rising sectarianism in the early part of the 20th century, but it doesn't destroy the Labor Party. The Labor Party initially sees it off, I think. There are attempts, for instance, by the Catholic Church, including a newly arrived assistant archbishop in Melbourne before the First World War called Daniel Mannix, to basically restore state aid for Catholic schools. I mean, that's a long-standing goal, but the Labor Party generally sees off those kinds of attempts. But sectarianism does become a feature, I think, of the split over conscription in 1916. Generally speaking, Catholic Labourites tended to go with the anti-conscription side, Protestant Labourites the other way. Labour became a much more Catholic party coming out of the conscription split and
so
the First
split
World War.
Between sort of king and pope between
it was and that's how it was often expressed. Yeah. It was how it was often expressed at the time. Mm. It's not a perfect map, by the way.
No,
I mean, there were
no.
Catholics who were conscriptionists and stayed in, and of course, you know, the Labor Party still has very large numbers of Protestants as well as people, you know, who are basically secularists. But
you remember, like, sorry to interrupt you, but I remember when Philip Lynch was the treasurer of Australia for the Liberal Party, and I think he may have been the first Catholic on the Conservative side to occupy that role.
Well, the Liberal Party came out of the 40s, and I'm not going to remember who it was, but there was one member, one Catholic in the Menzies cabinet, and Menzies would joke, oh, here comes the papists, you know, in a sort of, you know, jovial kind of way. So it that reflected really the history of post-split, post-World War II, post-World War I, I should say, political parties, you know, where there was a kind of an identity of interest, I suppose, between the Catholic Church and the Catholic community and the Labor Party, and a tendency to define, you know, non-Labor politics in terms of Protestantism. It has an ideological dimension too. I mean, we were talking about the very individualistic nature of Morrison's Pentecostalism. Well, you know, Judith Brett's made the argument that the kind of broadly collectivist understanding of Catholicism, you know, fit better with Labor Party ideology, whereas the emphasis on individual conscience, you know, fit better with the non-Labor parties, the Liberal parties and so on. You know, the Labor has a caucus system. It has a stricter party discipline. All of that maps rather better onto a Catholic view of the world and Catholic notions of authority and obedience, perhaps, than, you know, what you get on the Protestant side.
Pentecostalism takes that even further really sort of supercharges that idea of the individual and the, you know, the personal relationship with God.
It does. I think it's a more radical version of that, and it's an individual relationship with, you know, one's conscience and one's God that matters in that kind of vision, but as you say, I mean, sectarianism remains a feature of the Labor Party. It was very prominent in the split of 1955-54, where, you know, that was a split in many ways. People talk of it being a split over communism, but in a lot of ways it was really a split over the appropriate role for the Catholic Church within politics. Obviously, it resulted in the breakaway party centred on Victoria, which gained the allegiance of many Catholics, eventually called the Democratic Labor Party.
Yeah, and didn't the Labor Party hate it? And, of course, anyone had anything to do with the Labor Party listened to what they were saying. You know, it was always said that the DLP kept Labor out of office for that Longfellow period between 49 and 72.
Yeah, I mean, not every year, of course, but, you know, the split itself simply weakened the Labor Party. It made it look like a rump, a little bit like what happened after 1916, really. I mean, it looked kind of as if it was somehow unrepresentative of the broader society. And Victoria was a particular problem through those years. I mean, it looked extreme. It was often said that the Masons, like a number of, you know, key figures in the Victorian Labor Party were Freemasons. And there was a strongly, you know, there was a kind of atmosphere anti-Catholicism, I gather, through the Labor Party in Victoria through those years. It was the pre-selection and victory at a by-election of Pauline Toner in mid-70s, who eventually became a minister in the Kaine government. Mm-hmm. And I think she was the first Catholic to be, you know, sort of pre-selected for a winnable seat in like decades. And that was very much a product of the conflicts of the mid-50s, really. An ageing Mannix, Bob Santamaria, a number of political players that are, I guess, are now forgotten by many people, but were very much a part of the furniture in those years. And yeah, it gave to politics a kind of religious and moral charge. Yeah.
What about the point you made before about the discipline of the Labor Party? Is it a coincidence that it's also been a very resilient party, that it's lasted all of this time? You know, yes, it's had these ructions and so forth, but has that internal discipline, is that coincident with that survival, or is it part of the reason?
Oh, I think it is a part of the reason. It's also the foundations of the party in the union movement. I mean, that's really what arguably a Labor Party is, and what differentiates a Labor Party from, say, a socialist or social democratic party or the Democratic Party in the United States. I mean, they have relationships with trade unions, obviously, but in the case of a Labor Party, the unions initiate it and then have a continuing formal role within it. And that remains the case today. And so, I mean, Vere Gordon-Childe was an archaeologist. He became a famous archaeologist, but in the 20s wrote a book called How Labor Governs and really argued that Labor had given a distinctive take to Australian democracy. And this was the idea that an individual MP, a minister, a government was not only responsible to the parliament or to the constituency or the electorate that had voted for them, they were responsible to the labour movement, and they were responsible to the labour movement through the party machinery. And so you have an elaborate machinery that not always successfully aims to impose discipline on individual MPs. And of course, as we know, it broke down in 1916, it broke down in 1930-31, it broke down again in 1955, but it remains a factor. I mean, it was the reason that Maurice Yemma lost the premiership of New South Wales as recently as, what was it, about 2008, if I remember rightly. It was essentially the conference imposing its will on the issue of electricity privatisation. Yeah. So you might think that, you know, oh, that belongs to the olden days, that sort of understanding of what the Labor Party is, but it's still embedded in its practices and structures today and effectively could override a government and a state premier in the right circumstances.
And so its strength, really, its institutional strength there, that kind of structure internally, that agreed meaning that is shared amongst its members, is its strength. But it's also something that's in tension with its presentation to voters because, of course, we know back in the height of the industrial age, there's very high union membership, and now it's around sort of 12.5%, I think, across the economy. A lot of that's in the public sector.
Yes.
And, you know, basically being seen to be run by unions, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, the reason for its strength and its success and for its effectiveness in a lot of ways, but it's also kind of baggage.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the sort of argument against Labor that it was just an instrument of unions or union bosses is very old. I mean, that's been around since the 1890s and has always been a part of the rhetoric that this was a party that could not represent the community or the public because it was ultimately the representative of a sectional interest. Interestingly, the same arguments would sometimes be used even by the Liberal Party against the Country Party when they were, you know, sort of in dispute. Oh, you people are just, you know, looking after the wheat farmers, you're not, you know, out for the public interest. So it's another interesting parallel, I think, between the two. Now, you're right, today the union density is much lower than it was 50, 60 years ago, in fact, much lower than it was even in the 1990s. And there is a critique that's come even from within the Labor Party. I'm thinking here of someone like Rodney Cavalier, former New South Wales Labor government minister, who has in the past, I don't think this is his position now, but certainly in the past has argued Labor should sever its links with the union movement because it has become a kind of incubus. That unions represent only a small fragment of the workforce. And then, in fact, in terms of unions affiliated with the Labor Party, because remember, many unions, while they'll be affiliated with the ACTU, they won't be affiliated with the Labor Party, it's even lower. And so he argues that what happens is it allows particular union officials to exercise an inordinate influence over the Labor Party. So that critique has sometimes come, you know, from people who are quite friendly to the Labor Party. The argument against it would be that we have labor laws in Australia that reward free riding. So you're never going to get under current laws more than a relatively small proportion of the workforce joining unions because the rest of the workforce or large parts of it, they get free enterprise bargaining services.
Yeah, they're getting the benefits of the negotiation anyway without having to pay for the dues.
Indeed. Yeah. So I'm cautious about those sorts of arguments because I think that even though unions might only represent, formally represent a small proportion of the workforce, their actual role within the industrial relations system remains very substantial.
Yeah. It's true, but in a sense, that process has been happening anyway. I mean, the economy is sort of delaminated in a way. The society has, we don't have those huge industry sectors where workers are geographically housed together and working together. And, you know, they're sort of perfect conditions really for union membership, but also for the concept of a sort of a collective class consciousness. That the economy has changed quite dramatically since then. So what do you see the future of the Labor Party? And this is, I know this has been a debate around for a long time because it's tied up in the idea that Labor eventually becomes the party of the inner cities, you know, that it's scrapping it out now with the Greens and the Teals, while Peter Dutton takes the Liberal Party after the sort of what used to be employees but are now contractors in the suburbs.
Yeah, no, that's right. And we talk about this towards the end of the, you know, in some of the really new writing in the book, that the ways in which those older workplaces, if you like, have sort of decomposed. You know, obviously we've been through a period of deindustrialisation now for decades, really. I think union density, that is union coverage, peaked as long ago as the 1940s. You know, I mean, it's not just a recent sort of decline. So these changes have been going on for a long time. In a lot of ways, Whitlamism was a response, one response to that, which basically argued that the Labor Party needed also to become the party of the professional middle classes, those that Judith Brett calls, you know, the moral middle class, you know, that sort of idea. And she argues that Whitlam, in fact, does take over some of that kind of role that had traditionally been outside the Labor Party, exemplified by someone like Menzies, really. So I think that, you know, as our society becomes more fragmented and more diverse, as our workplaces, they de-unionise, obviously service industries, the gig economy, all these kinds of developments that we're all familiar with, the task, and we say this at the end of the book, the task of actually constructing a kind of winning coalition at any particular election becomes all the more difficult. And, you know, we can see this happening right now. I mean, I would have thought the Albanese government, I'm not the biggest fan of the Albanese government going round, but I think it's a fair job. I mean, I look at it across, you know, 130 years of Labor Party. It's been a pretty reasonable sort of government on the whole. But, you know, it hangs in there. Its majority is what, 4 or something?
It's not three, managed. I think it's not, that was 2. It's actually increased its majority between elections, which hasn't happened in 102 years.
Yes.
Not in terms of the majority over the coalition.
Yeah, with Aston.
Or the opposition.
Yeah, absolutely. So with Aston Bolshe, but still very slim majority. And I think that at the moment, at least, the sort of received wisdom is that it's going to really struggle to maintain a majority at the next election, that it could well slip into some form of minority government. Now, I think
it could lose.
It would be the first since Scullin to lose in a single term, but it could do that. It's certainly not an easy way for a majority coalition government, I think, at the next election. I think that would require extraordinary turnaround. But, you know, I think that underlines the difficulty that Labor has.
It's a volatile electorate these days.
Absolutely.
It's a volatile electorate. I don't think it's out of the question. I mean, I've written sort of both ways on this. I accept that the orthodoxy is that it's pretty hard to imagine a majority Dutton government, pretty hard to imagine his path to 76 seats, for example, from where he is at the moment. But there is a big crossbench. There could be a bigger crossbench.
Absolutely.
We just don't know. There could be a bigger crossbench after the next election. This goes to finally something else I want to raise with you, and that is a lament you often hear in Labor circles, that Labor gets elected when there's tough things to be done, when changes need to happen, and has had some pretty bad luck along the way as well. If we think about Whitlam and the oil shock in 73 from the Yom Kippur War, and we think about Rudd getting elected in right at the end of 2007, and by early 2008, you've got the first ructions of the GFC, which change everything, you know, change the whole political calculus. We, you know, obviously talk about the situation now that the government finds itself in a, you know, suddenly the economy has become very, very difficult. The first move happened before the 22 election, but really the pain only kicked in after that. And we've seen, you know, it's a very difficult environment in which to govern at the moment, cost of living crisis and the like. Are Labor people right to be talking about those sorts of things? And is Labor really the party that's brought in when tough stuff needs to be done?
Yeah, whether it's a kind of, I don't know, some sort of
folklore.
Well, it's not folklore. It's true. I mean, I think, yeah, it's demonstrably true. Labor's elected during the early stages of the First World War. It finds itself in government in the Second World War. Yes, the end of the long boom in the 70s, the economic challenges of the mid-80s with the, you know, the Banana Republic crisis, the GFC. Absolutely. I mean, it's demonstrably true. It may be that it's kind of not really a dynamic so much as just something that has happened. You know? I mean, we're talking about a small number of cases. There aren't many Labor governments, you know, federally, nationally. Yeah, and it's probably shaped perceptions of the Labor Party amongst the broader public, that it's often been a crisis manager. And I think crisis managers always face the problem of negative judgments because it's difficult to manage crises. It's obviously much easier to manage abundance, as Whitlam might have put it, or to plan for abundance was his phrase, than it is to deal with scarcity, at least nationally. I think it is a different situation in the States, where I think there have been quite different sorts of developments, but certainly nationally, I think that's broadly been true, and it shaped, I think, our political culture and the way in which we see politics in this country.
Yeah, and managing scarcity is a difficulty, as Chifley found out, and as Churchill found out, indeed in Britain, immediately after the war as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose this government's dealing with a little bit of that at the moment. We've got a budget next week, and the government's hands are tied to a large extent in terms of how much it can do without feeding the inflation dragon, as they say.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, in the end, I mean, the Morrison government faced an extraordinary crisis, didn't it, in the pandemic?
Yeah, but it did. It was a bit like the GFC in the sense that the initial medicine, you know, politically speaking or economically speaking, was quite popular. I remember, you know, being there watching the government in 2008 have to pivot from its promise of delivering budget surpluses and being fiscally very, very cautious and so forth. Mm. It just literally had to sort of pull the hyper-Keynesian lever and say, right, we're going to stimulate the hell out of the economy and basically putting checks in people's pockets. Now, as hard as that was politically, in a sense, to do a U-turn, I mean, there was a sense, I think, amongst ministers that someone's going to have to pay for this down the track, but it has to be done now. We have to err on the side of caution, which means err on the side of overcompensating rather than undercompensating. Yeah. And there's a sort of a popularity about it. And I think that was probably true in the start of the pandemic as well, when we learned something about Australia, really, I think, which was Australia has a different and far less antagonistic relationship with itself, with the government, with the state, than do Americans and some others. We looked to our government to take decisive action.
Yeah, I've argued sort of in a few places, I guess, that, you know, when we look at something like JobKeeper in particular, that, you know, it's rooted in a very deep political history in this country, going right back really, I think, arguably to the earliest years of settlement. I mean, it sort of extends that kind of idea that the role of government is ultimately to look after people, to ensure that there is a kind of minimum below which they won't fall.
Yeah.
And that was true of the very early, I mean, the key institution in early colonial Australia was called the commissariat, and its role was kind of public-private partnership in a way. I mean, it was the government store, and its role was to provide, you know, clothing and food for convicts. Private businesses, farmers would sell their stuff to it. I mean, it was the colony's banker. Right. I mean, its receipts were essentially the only currency or main currency of the colony. When JobKeeper was being rolled out a few years back, I mean, I could, you know, see or hear, I should say, the echoes of that sort of approach. And I think to understand the Labor Party's role in Australian national politics is to understand the ways in which it's generally worked with the grain of that kind of political culture.
It's a really interesting point.
You know, the living wage concept, a whole range, you know, relatively generous welfare state, although a targeted one, but a whole range of ways in which I think Labor has worked with the grain of that political culture. And of course, as we've often seen, non-Labor has done it very successfully in particular periods too. We were talking about Tom Playford earlier, but it's true of Menzies as well. I mean, that extraordinary achievement of home ownership that happened after the Second World War. I mean, it had the state's fingerprints all over it in regulated interest rates and all the rest of it that, you know, saw home ownership go from what? About 50%, I think, to 71% or something in 15 years.
Yeah, that's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was very much something that was guided and shaped by government policy, by governments being willing to intervene. So, Yeah, I mean, it's not just
Labor. And the coalition's embrace now of Medicare, for example, even though they got rid of Medibank initially, but the Whitlam program. But once Labor was able to bed down Medicare, and eventually you had Tony Abbott saying, "We're the best friend Medicare has ever had," you know, chanting it in Parliament, because they'd lost the argument because they knew where the Australian people were on that, and we wanted universal health insurance.
Yeah, they took a while. I mean, they took a long time.
They took a while, and each time they paid for it.
They took a hit, I mean, there's research that says that was more critical than the GST as an issue in 93. I mean, but, yeah, it does seem to me that, you know, when we look at some of these policies that, you know, sometimes have come from coalition governments, we also need to look at the broader political environment to which the Labor Party has contributed significantly if we want to understand them. We need a more holistic understanding of how policy happens, I think. And it doesn't just happen, you know, so it doesn't jump out of the brain, if you like, of a particular individual or political party. It's usually rooted in a particular way of understanding the role of the state and the relationship between state and society. And I think Labor in Australia has been a very important part of that story.
That's a good note to end on. Thanks, Frank. It's been really terrific talking about this book. It's called A Little History of the Australian Labor Party. It's from New South and highly recommend it.
Thanks, Ark. And I've obviously worked with Nick Dyrenforth on this and we had a great time doing it once again. Yeah.
Terrific. That's Democracy Sausage. Talk to you again next week.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.